of my heart, and all I could do was nod mutely. She went to the kitchen and retrieved clean tumblers for the vodka, while Sonny and I sat in awkward silence. The vodka, when served, was as pungent and wonderful as I had imagined it would be, the paint thinner I needed to strip down the stained, flaking walls of my interior. "Maybe we'll go to Japan someday," Sonny said. "I'd like to meet Abe." "I'd like you to meet him, too," said Miss Mori. "He's a fighter, just like you are." Vodka was good for honesty, especially on ice, as mine was. Vodka on ice was so transparent, so clear, so powerful, it inspired its drinkers to be the same. I swallowed the rest of mine, preparing myself for the bruises sure to come. "There's something I've always wondered since our college days, Sonny. You always talk then about how much you believed in the people and the revolution so much. You should have heard of Miss Mori. He gave very good speeches."
"I would have liked to hear them," Miss Mori said, "very much."
"But if you had heard them, you would have asked yourself why he didn't go back and fight for the revolution he believed in, or why he doesn't go back now and be a part of the people and the revolution tomorrow. Even your brother Abe went to prison and went to Japan for what he believed in."
"And look where that's got him," said Miss Mori.
"I'd just like an answer to my question, Sonny. Are you still here because you're in love with Miss Mori? Or are you still here because you're afraid?" He winced. I had hit him where it hurt, in the solar plexus of his conscience, where everyone who was an idealist was vulnerable. Disarming an idealist was easy. One only needed to ask why the idealist was not on the front line of the particular battle he had chosen. The question was one of commitment, and I knew, even if he did not, that I was one of the committed. He looked at his bare feet, ashamed. But for some reason, this had no effect on Miss Mori. She only glanced at him with understanding. But when she turned her full gaze to me, it remained marked by pity and something else, regret. It was time to stop and make a graceful exit, but the vodka that could not drain fast enough through the plugged-up sinkhole in the basement of my heart compelled me to swim on. "You always talk with so much admiration of the people," I said. "If you want to be with the people so much, go home." "He is home here," Miss Mori said. I had never wanted her more than she was now, smoking a cigarette and fighting back. "He stayed here because the people are here, too. There's work to be done with them and for them. Can't you see that? Isn't this your home now, too?" Sonny laid his hand on her arm and said, "Sophia." There was a lump in my throat, but I could not swallow, watching her put her hand on his. "Don't defend me. He's right." I was right? I had never heard him say this before. I should have been joyful, but it was more and more evident that there was little I could say that would persuade Miss Mori to turn her heart or her mind away from Sonny. He swallowed the rest of his vodka and said, "I've lived in this country for 14 years now. In a few more years, I'll have spent as much time here as I have in our homeland. That was never my intention. I came here, like you, just to study. I remember so clearly saying farewell to my parents at the airport and promising them that I would come back and help our country. I'd have an American degree, the best education the world could offer. I'd use that knowledge and help our people liberate themselves from the Americans. Or so I hoped." He held out his glass to Miss Mori, and she poured him a double. After taking a sip, he continued, looking somewhere between Miss Mori and myself. "What I learned, against my will, is that it's impossible to live among a foreign people and not become changed by them." He swirled his vodka and knocked it back in one punishing swallow. "Sometimes I feel a little foreign to myself as a result," he said. "I admit that I am afraid. I admit my cowardice, my hypocrisy, my weakness, and my shame. I admit that you are a better man than me. I don't agree with your politics. I despise them. But you went home when you had the choice, and you fought the fight that you believed in. You stood up for the people as you see them. For that, I respect you." I could not believe it. I had gotten him to confess to his failures and to surrender. I had won an argument with Sonny, something I had never done in our college days. So why was Miss Mori clinging to his hand and murmuring something soothing? "It's all right," she said. "I know exactly how you feel." "It's all right." I needed another drink. "Look at me, Sonny," Miss Mori went on. "What am I, a secretary for a white man who thinks he's complimenting me when he calls me Miss Butterfly? Do I protest and tell him to go to hell? No,
I smile and say nothing and continue typing. I'm no better than you, Sonny. They stared into each other's eyes as if I did not exist. I refilled all of our glasses, but it was only me who took a slug. The part that was me said, I love you, Miss Morey. No one heard that. What they heard was the part that was playing say, It's never too late to fight, is it, Miss Morey? Their spell was broken. Sonny turned his gaze back to me. He had performed some kind of intellectual judo and turned my blow against myself. But he exhibited none of the triumph he would have in our college days. No, it's never too late to fight, he said, sober despite the wine and vodka. You are quite right about that, my friend. Yeah, Miss Morey said. In the way she slowly exhaled that syllable, in the way she focused on Sonny with a hungry intensity never shown toward me, in the way she chose that word over yes, I knew it was all over between us. I had won the argument, but somehow, as in our college days, he had won the audience. The general also thought it was never too late to fight, as I reported in the next letter to my Parisian aunt. He had found an isolated stretch of terrain to carry out the training and maneuvers for his nascent army in the sun-exposed hills far east of Los Angeles, near a remote Indian reservation. Some 200 men had driven themselves across the freeways and past the suburbs and exurbs to this stretch of scrubby land where, in the past, the mob might have buried a few of its victims. Our gathering was not as strange a thing as it might have appeared. A xenophobe would see a company of foreigners in camouflage uniforms, carrying out military drills and calisthenics, and might imagine us to be the lead element of some nefarious Asian invasion of the American homeland. A yellow peril in the Golden State, a diabolical dream of Ming the Merciless sprung to life. Far from it. The general's men, by preparing themselves to invade our now communist homeland, were in fact turning themselves into new Americans. After all, nothing was more American than wielding a gun and committing oneself to die for freedom and independence, unless it was wielding that gun to take away someone else's freedom and independence. 10 score of the best, the general had called these men in his restaurant, where he had sketched out for me the organization of his compact army on a napkin. I later pocketed that napkin and sent it to my Parisian aunt, the sketch depicting a headquarters platoon, 3 rifle platoons, and a heavy weapons platoon, even though there were as yet no heavy weapons. No problem, said the general. Southeast Asia is awash in heavy weaponry. We'll get them there. Here the goal is to build discipline, harden bodies, prepare minds, get these volunteers to think of themselves as an army again, get them to imagine the future. He wrote down the names of the platoon commanders and the officers of his staff, explaining to me their histories. This one, formerly the executive officer from such-and-such division, this one formerly a battalion commander from such-and-such regiment, and so on. These details I transmitted to my Parisian aunt as well, this time in arduous code. I also paraphrased what the general told me, that these were all experienced men, down to the lowliest private. They've all seen action back home, he said, all volunteers. I didn't put out a general call. I organized my officers first, had them contact men they trust, who would be the non-commissioned officers. Then had the NCOs find the enlisted men. It's taken over a year to collect this nucleus. Now we're ready for the next phase. Physical training, drilling, maneuvers, turning them into a fighting unit. Are you with me, Captain? Always, sir. This was how I found myself in uniform again, although my task for the day was to be documentarian rather than foot soldier. The 200 or so men sat Indian style on the earth, legs crossed, while the general stood before them and I stood behind them, camera in hand. Like his men, the general was uniformed in battle camouflage, purchased at an army surplus store and tailored by the madame to fit. In his uniform, the general was no longer the morose proprietor of a liquor store and a restaurant, a petty bourgeois who counted his hopes as he did the change in his register. His uniform, his red beret, his polished field boots, the stars on his collar, and the airborne patch on his sleeve had restored him to the nobility he had once possessed in our homeland. As for my uniform, it was a suit of armor cut from cloth. Though a bullet or knife would have sliced through the uniform with ease, I felt less vulnerable than in my everyday civilian clothes. If I was not bulletproof, I was at least charmed, as all the men were. I photographed them from several different angles, these men who had been humbled by what they had been turned into here in exile, in their working outfits as busboys, waiters, gardeners, field hands, fishermen, manual laborers, custodians, or simply the un- and underemployed. These shabby examples of the lumpen blended into the background wherever they happened to be, always seen as a mass, never noticed as individuals. But now, in uniform and with their raggedy haircuts hidden by field caps and berets, they were impossible to miss. Their renewed manhood was manifest in the way their backs were stiff and straight, rather than slouched in the refugee slump, and in the way they marched proudly across the earth, rather than shuffling as they usually did in cheap shoes with worn-down soles. They were men again, and that was how the general addressed them. "Men," he called out. "Men! The people need us." Even from where I was, I heard him clearly, though he seemed to exert no effort in projecting his voice. "They need hope and leaders," the general said. "You are those leaders. You will show the people what can happen if they have the courage to rise up, to take arms, and to sacrifice themselves." I watched the men to see if they would flinch at the idea of sacrificing themselves, but they did not. This was the occult power of the uniform, of the mass, that men who would never dream of sacrificing themselves in the course of their everyday lives, waiting on tables, would agree to do so while waiting under a hot sun. "Men," the general said, "men. The people cry out for freedom. The communists promise freedom and independence, but deliver only poverty and enslavement. They have betrayed the Vietnamese people, and revolutions don't betray the people. Even here, we remain with the people, and we will return to liberate the people who have been denied the freedom given to us. Revolutions are for the people, from the people, by the people. That is our revolution." Nothing was so true, and yet nothing was so mysterious, for the questions of who the people were and what they might want remained unanswered. The lack of an answer mattered not. Indeed, the lack of an answer was part of the power in the idea of the people that brought the men to their feet and the tears to their eyes as they shouted, "Down with communism!" Like salmon that instinctively knew when to swim upstream, we all knew who the people were and who were not the people. Anyone who had to be told who the people were probably was not part of the people, or so I soon wrote to my Parisian aunt. I also sent her photos of the cheering men in uniforms, along with others showing them exercising and engaging in maneuvers the rest of that weekend. Perhaps these men looked silly or foolish, doing push-ups while the grizzled captain yelled at them, or crouching behind trees aiming vintage rifles under the command of the effectless lieutenant, or conducting a mock patrol with Bond amid the brush where Indians once hunted. "Don't be fooled," I warned man in my coded notes. "Revolutions begin this way, with men willing to fight no matter what the odds, volunteering to give up everything because they had nothing." This was an apt description of the grizzled captain, the former guerrilla hunter who was now a short-order cook, and the effectless lieutenant, sole survivor of an ambush company, who made his living as a delivery man. Like Bond, they were certifiably insane men who had volunteered for the reconnaissance mission to Thailand. They had decided that death was just as good as life, which was fine for them, but was worrisome for me if I was to go along with them. "What about your wives and kids?" I said. The four of us sat under an oak tree, sleeves rolled up past our elbows, eating a midday meal of army surplus sea rations, which looked almost exactly the same entering the human body as they did exiting it. The grizzled captain rattled his spoon in his can and said, "We got separated during the whole mess at Da Nang. They didn't make it out. Last I heard, the VC sent them to clear swampland for the crime of being related to me. Guess I can either wait for them to get out or I can go get them myself." He had the habit of speaking with his teeth clenched, gnawing at his words like bones. As for the effectless lieutenant, his emotional strings had been cut. He had the semblance of a human being, but while his body moved, his face and voice moved not at all. Thus, when he said, "They're dead," the toneless announcement was more forbidding than if he had ever wailed or cursed. I was afraid to ask him what happened. Instead, I said,
You guys don't plan on coming back, do you? The effectless lieutenant rotated the turret of his head a few degrees and aimed his eyes at me. Come back to what?
The grizzled captain chuckled. Don't be shocked, kid. I've ordered more than a few men to certain death. Now maybe it's my turn. Not that I want to sound all emotional. Don't feel sorry for me. I'm looking forward to it. Or maybe hell, but you know what? Hell's better than this shithole.
With that, the effectless lieutenant and the grizzled captain departed to take a piss.
I didn't need to write in my letter to Paris that these men were not fools, at least not yet. The Minutemen were not fools in believing they could defeat the British Redcoats, any more than the first armed propaganda platoon of our revolution was foolish, as it drilled with a motley assembly of primitive weapons. From that militia eventually arose an army of 1 million men. Who was to say the same fate did not await this company? Dear Aunt, I wrote in visible ink, these men are not to be underestimated. Napoleon said men will die for bits of ribbon pinned to their chest, but the general understands that even more men will die for a man who remembered their names, as he does theirs. When he inspects them, he walks among them, eats with them, calls them by their names, and asks about wives, children, girlfriends, hometowns. All anyone ever wants is to be recognized and remembered. Neither is possible without the other. This desire drives these bus boys, waiters, janitors, gardeners, mechanics, night guards, and welfare beneficiaries to save enough money to buy themselves uniforms, boots, and guns, to want to be men again. They want their country back, dear aunt, but they also yearn for recognition and remembrance from that country that no longer exists, from wives and children, from future descendants, from the men they used to be. If they fail, call them fools. But if they do not fail, they are heroes and visionaries, whether alive or dead. Perhaps I shall return with them to our country, regardless of what the general has to say. Even as I was planning for the possibility of returning, I also did my best to dissuade Bonn of doing the same. We were smoking a final cigarette under the oak tree, our last gesture before embarking on a 10-mile hike. We watched as the men commanded by the grizzled captain and the effectless lieutenant rose and stretched, scratching at various parts of their lumpy bodies. "Those guys have death wishes," I said. "Don't you get it? They've got no intention of coming back. They know it's a suicide mission." "Life's a suicide mission." "That's very philosophical of you," I said. "It doesn't change the fact that you're crazy." He laughed with genuine humor, such a rare occasion ever since Saigon, I was taken aback. For only the second time since I had known him, he embarked on a speech that was, for him, an epic. "What's crazy is living when there's no reason to live," he said. "What am I living for? A life in our apartment? That's not a home. It's a jail cell without bars. All of us, we're all in jail cells without bars. We're not men anymore, not after the Americans fucked us twice and made our wives and kids watch. First the Americans said, 'Well, save your yellow skins. Just do what we say, fight our way, take our money, give us your women, then you'll be free.' Now, things didn't work out that way, did they? Then, after fucking us, they rescued us. They just didn't tell us they'd cut off our balls and cut out our tongues along the way. But you know what? If we were real men, we wouldn't have let them do that." Usually, Bond used words like a sniper, but this was a spray of machine gun fire that silenced me for several moments. Then I said, "You don't give these guys enough credit for what they did, for what they faced. Though they were my enemies, I understood their soldiers' hearts, beating with the belief that they had fought bravely. You're being too hard on them." He laughed again, this time without humor. "I'm hard on myself. Don't call me a man or a soldier either. Call the guys who stayed behind men and soldiers. The men in my company, man, all dead or in prison, but at least they know they're men. They're so dangerous it takes other men with guns to keep them locked up. Here, no one's frightened of us. The only people we scare are our wives and kids, and ourselves. I know these guys. I sell them liquor, I hear their stories. They come home from work, yell at their wives and kids, beat them once in a while just to show that they're men. Only they're not. A man protects his wife and children. A man isn't afraid to die for them, his country, his buddies.
He doesn't live to see them all die before him. But that's what I've done.
You retreated, that's all, I said, putting my hand on his shoulder. He shrugged it off. I had never seen him speak about his pain so bluntly before. I wanted to comfort him, and it hurt me that he would not let me.
You had to save your family. That doesn't make you less of a man or a soldier.
You are a soldier, so think like one. Is it better to go on this suicide mission and not come back, or is it better to go with the next wave that's actually got a chance?
He spat and ground out his cigarette against the heel of his boot, then buried it under a mound of dirt. That's what most of these guys are saying. They're losers, and losers always have excuses. They dress up, talk tough, play soldier. But how many are really going back home to fight? The general asked for volunteers. He got 3. The rest of them hide behind their wives and kids, the same wives and kids they beat because they can't stand hiding behind them. Give a coward a second chance, he'll just run again. So it is with most of these guys. They're bluffing.
You cynical bastard, I cried.
What are you dying for, then?
What am I dying for? He cried back. I'm dying because this world I'm living in isn't worth dying for. If something is worth dying for, then you've got a reason to live.
And to this, I had nothing to say. It was true, even for this small detachment of heroes or perhaps fools. Whatever they were, they now had something to live for, if not die for. They had eagerly shed the funeral clothes of their mediocre civilian lives, understanding the allure of tailored tiger stripe fatigues with dashing scarves of yellow, white, or red around their necks, a military splendor akin to the costumes of superheroes. But, like superheroes, they would not want to keep themselves a secret for long. How could you be a superhero if no one knew you existed? Rumors had already spread about them, even before the Desert Assembly. During that night, when Sonny had admitted his failure and yet still won, he had asked me about these mysterious men. The wheels of our conversation had stopped spinning. The black cat was gloating over my defeat, and in the vodka-infused silence, Sonny raised the reports of a secret army preparing for a secret invasion. I replied that I had not heard of any such thing, to which he said, "Don't play the innocent. You're the general's man." "If I were his man," I said, "more reason not to tell a communist."
"Who said I'm a communist?"
I pretended to be surprised.
"You're not a communist?"
"If I were, would I tell you?"
That was the subversive dilemma. Rather than flaunt ourselves in the sexually dubious costumes of superheroes, we hid beneath cloaks of invisibility, here just as in Saigon. There, when I attended the clandestine meetings with other subversives, conducted in the fusty cellars of safe houses, sitting on crates of black market hand grenades manufactured in the USA, I donned a clammy cotton hood that revealed only my eyes. Lit by candlelight or oil lamp, we knew one another only by the peculiarity of our aliases, by the shape of our bodies, by the sound of our voices, by the whites of our eyes. Now, watching Miss Maury recline under Sonny's arm, I was sure my ever-absorbent eyes were no longer white, but bloodshot from the wine, vodka, and tobacco. Our lungs had achieved smoky equilibrium with the stale air, while on the coffee table the ashtray silently suffered its usual indignity, mouth crammed full of butts and bitter ash. I dropped what remained of my cigarette into the well of the wine bottle, where it drowned in the remaining liquid with a faint, reproachful hiss.
"The war's over," Miss Morris said. "Don't they know that?" I wanted to say something profound as I stood up to say good night. I wanted to impress Miss Maury with the intellect she could never have again.
"Wars never die," I said. "They just go to sleep."
"Is that true for old soldiers, too?" she asked, not looking impressed.
"Of course it's true," Sonny said.
"If they don't go to sleep, how else would they dream?" I almost answered before I realized it was a rhetorical question. Miss Maury offered me her cheek to kiss, and Sonny offered me his hand to shake. He showed me the door, and I slid home through the cool sheets of night and into my own bed, Bon asleep and hovering above me in his rack. I closed my eyes and, after a spell of darkness, floated on my mattress across a black river to the foreign country that needed no passport to visit. Of its many gnomic features and shady denizens, I now recall only one, my mind wiped clean except for this fatal fingerprint, an ancient kapok tree that was my final resting place,
and on whose arthritic bark I laid my cheek. I was almost asleep within my sleep, when I gradually understood that the knot of gnarled wood on which my ear rested was actually an ear itself, curled and stiff, the wax of its auditory history encrusted in the green moss of its twisted canal. Half of the kapok tree towered above me, half was invisible below me in the rooted earth, and when I looked up, I saw not just one ear, but many ears swelling from the bark of its thick trunk, hundreds of ears listening and having listened to things I could not hear. The sight of those ears so horrible would hurl me back into the Black River. I woke, drenched and gasping, clutching the sides of my head. Only after I kicked off the damp sheets and looked under the pillow could I lie down again, trembling. My heart still beat with the force of a savage drummer, but at least my bed was not littered with amputated ears. Chapter 14. Sometimes the work of a subversive is purposeful, but sometimes, I confess, it is accidental. In retrospect, perhaps my questioning of Sonny's courage pushed him to write the headline that I saw 2 weeks after the field maneuvers, "Move On, War Over." I saw it on the general's desk in his war room at the liquor store, fixed squarely on the writing pad and weighed down by a stapler. The sentiments of the headline might be hailed by some, but certainly not the general. Beneath that headline was a photograph of a rally staged by the fraternity at a Westminster park, with ranks and files of grim veterans in paramilitary uniforms of brown shirts and red berets. In another photo, civilians in the cast-off couture of refugees waved signs and clutched banners with the telegraphic messages of political protest. Ho Chi Minh equals Hitler. Freedom for our people. Thank you, America. To the degree that the article might sow doubt in the hearts of exiles about continuing the war and create divisions among exile factions, I knew that my provocation of Sonny had had an unintentional but desirable effect. I photographed the article with the Minox mini camera that was finally finding some use. For the last few weeks, I had been photographing the general's files, all of which I had access to as his aide-de-camp. Ever since my return from the Philippines, I had been unemployed except for this considerable pro bono work done for the general, the fraternity, and the movement. Even secret armies and political fronts needed clerks. Memos must be written, documents filed, meetings called, flyers designed, printed, and distributed, photos taken, interviews scheduled, donors found, and, most important for my purposes, correspondence taken and mailed, then received and read before it was handed over to the general. I had photographed the general's complete order of battle, from the company here to the battalion in Thailand, from the fraternity's public parades to the movement's private maneuvers, as well as the communiques between the general and his officers in the Thai refugee camps, led by a landlocked admiral. Not least, I photographed the statements of the bank accounts where the general stashed the modest funds of the movement, raised in small donations from the refugee community, the revenues of Madame's restaurants, and a handful of respectable charitable organizations that had donated to the fraternity for the relief of sad refugees and sadder veterans. All this information had been packaged into a parcel dispatched to my Parisian aunt. The parcel's contents were a letter and a chintzy souvenir, an automatically rotating snowball featuring the Hollywood sign. This gift required 9-volt batteries, which I included, and which I had hollowed out. Into each I inserted a cartridge of Minox film, a more sophisticated method than how my courier in Saigon traded information with me. When Mann first told me of my courier, I had immediately conjured up one of those supple beauty queens for which our country was deservedly famous, white as refined sugar on the outside, scarlet as sunrise on the inside, a Cochin Chinese Matahari. What showed up at my door every morning was an aging auntie, the lines on her face promising more secrets than the lines on her palms, hawking gobs of Betelgeuse as well as her specialty, sticky rice wrapped in banana leaves. I bought a packet for breakfast every morning, and in it there might or might not be a message, rolled and wrapped in plastic. Likewise, in the small wad of folded piastres I paid her with, there might or might not be a cartridge of film or a message of my own, written invisibly with rice water on cement paper. The only flaw in this method was that Auntie was a terrible cook. Her sticky rice, a ball of glue that I had to swallow, lest a maid find it in my garbage and wonder why I was buying what I would not eat. I complained to Auntie once, but she cursed me at such length and with such inventiveness, I had to check both my watch and my dictionary. Even the Ciclo drivers hanging around the general's villa for fares were impressed. "You better marry that one, Captain," a driver missing a left arm called out. "She won't be single for long." I winced at the memory and poured myself a drink from the bottle of 15-year-old scotch the general kept in his drawer. Given that I was not being paid, the general kept me happy and admittedly dependent, with generous gifts of fine and not-so-fine liquor from his ample supply. I needed it. Written invisibly in the letter were the dates and details of Bond's itinerary, and those of the grizzled captain and the effectless lieutenant, from their airplane tickets to the location of the training camp. The information was no different in substance from what I had dispatched to Auntie. The classified logistics of operations that would inevitably lead to devastating ambushes. Newspaper articles would report the number of American or Republican soldiers dead or wounded, but they were as abstract as the faceless dead in history books. I could write these dispatches with ease, but the one about Bond had taken me all night, not because of the amount of words, but because he was my friend. "I'm coming back, too," I wrote, even though I had not yet figured out how I would do that. "The better to report on the movement of the enemy," I wrote, even though what I really intended was to save Bond's life. This feat I also had no idea how to accomplish, but ignorance had never stopped me from taking action before. With no idea how I would manage to betray Bond and save him at the same time, I searched for inspiration in the bottom of a bottle. I was sipping from my second tumbler of scotch when the general entered. It was a little past 3, the routine time of his return from Madame's restaurant after its midday rush. He was, as usual, irritated from his hours manning the cash register. Former soldiers would salute him, a sign of respect that nevertheless reminded him of the stars he was not wearing. While the occasional snide civilian, always a woman, would say, "Weren't you that general?" If she was very snide, she would leave him the tip, the typically grand sum of $1, our nod to what we considered a ludicrous American practice. Thus the general would arrive in the afternoons at the liquor store, as he did today, throw a handful of crumpled dollar bills on his desk, and wait for me to pour him a double. Reclining in his chair, he would sip the scotch with closed eyes and sigh dramatically. But today, instead of reclining, he leaned forward at his desk, tapped the newspaper, and said, "Did you read this?" Not wanting to deprive the general of the opportunity to fulminate, I said I had not. He nodded grimly and began to read excerpts out loud. "Rumors abound about this fraternity and what its true purpose is," the general said, face blank and voice even. "The overthrow of the communist regime is clearly its objective, but how far is it willing to go? While the fraternity asks for donations to help refugees, these funds may possibly be going toward a movement of armed refugees in Thailand. Rumors are that the fraternity has invested in certain businesses whose profits it reaps. The most disappointing aspect of the fraternity is the false hope it peddles to our countrymen that we can one day take our country back through force. We would be better off if we pursued reconciliation peacefully, in the hopes that one day we, in exile, can return to help rebuild our country." The general folded the newspaper and laid it back on his desk in the exact same position it had occupied before. "Someone's been feeding this man some reliable information, Captain." I sipped my scotch to disguise the fact that I was swallowing the saliva that had pooled in my mouth. "We have leaks, sir, just like we did at home. Look at that picture. All those men know something about what's going on. All Sonny had to do was walk around with a bucket, catching one drop here and another drop there. Soon enough he'd have a glass or two of information." "You're right, of course," the general said. "We can keep mistresses, but we can't keep secrets. This," he tapped the newspaper, "sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Reconcile, return, and rebuild. Who wouldn't want that? And who would benefit the most? The communists. But for us, the greater likelihood if we return is a bullet in the head or a long stay in re-education. That's what the communists mean by reconciliation and rebuilding, getting rid of people like us. And this newsman is peddling this leftist propaganda to poor people who are desperate for any kind of hope."
He's getting more troublesome, don't you think?
Of course, I said, reaching for the bottle of scotch.
Like me, it was half empty and half full. Newsmen are always troublesome if they're independent.
How do we know he's just a newsman?
Half of the newsmen in Saigon were communist sympathizers, and a good percentage of them were just communists.
How do we know the communists didn't send him here years ago with exactly this plan in mind,
to spy on any of us who made it here and undermine us?
You knew him in college. Did he display these sympathies back then?
If I said no, and the general later heard otherwise from someone else, I would be in trouble. The only answer was, yes, to which the general said,
"As my intelligence officer, you're not showing much intelligence, are you, Captain? Why didn't you warn me of this when I met him?"
The general shook his head in disgust.
"Do you know what your problem is, Captain?"
I had rather a long list of my problems, but it was better to simply say I had no idea.
"You're too sympathetic," the general said. "You didn't see the danger in the major because he was fat, and you took pity on him for that. Now the evidence shows that you've been willfully blind to the fact that Sonny is not only a left-wing radical, but potentially a communist sleeper agent."
The general's gaze was intense. My face started to itch, but I did not dare to scratch.
"Something may need to be done, Captain. Don't you agree?"
"Yes," I said, throat dry.
"Something may need to be done."
I had plenty of time to contemplate the general's vague demand in the ensuing days. How could one disagree with something needing to be done? Something always needed doing by somebody. An ad in Sonny's newspaper announcing that Lana was singing as part of a review called Fantasia provided me the opportunity for action, although not the kind the general likely had in mind. What I needed was a vacation, if only for one night, from the stressful, solitary work of being a subversive. For a mole used to darkness, a nightclub was an ideal place to emerge. Persuading Bond to go to Fantasia to hear the songs and sounds of our gone but not forgotten country was less of a struggle than I thought it would be, for Bond, having decided to die, was finally showing signs of life. He even allowed me to cut his hair, which he afterward slicked down with Brill Cream until it matched our glossy black shoes.
The Brill Cream and our cologne lent my car an intoxicatingly masculine atmosphere as we listened to the Rolling Stones,
the car transporting us not only west to Hollywood, but back to the glory days of Saigon circa 1969, after my return from America. Then, before Bon and Man became fathers, the three of us had wasted the weekends of our youth in Saigon's bars and nightclubs, exactly as one was supposed to do. If youth was not wasted, how could it be youth? Perhaps I could blame youth for my friendship with Bon. What drives a 14-year-old to swear a blood oath to a blood brother? And more important, what makes a grown man believe in that oath? Should not the things that count, like ideology and political belief, the ripe fruit of our adulthood, matter more than the unripe ideals and illusions of youth? Let me propose that truth, or some measure of it, can be found in these youthful follies that we forget, to our loss, as adults. Here was the scene of how our friendship first became established. A football pitch of the lycée, myself a new student surrounded by older, taller ones,
the prancing steeds of the school.
They were about to repeat a scene rehearsed by man from the dawn of time, the moment when the strong turn on the weak or odd for sport. I was odd, but I was not weak, as I had proven against the village comedian who called me unnatural. Although I had beaten him, I had also been beaten before, and I prepared myself for a losing fight. It was then that another new boy unexpectedly spoke out in my defense, stepping forward from the ring of warriors and saying, "This isn't right. Don't single him out. He's one of us." An older boy scoffed. "Who are you to say who's one of us? And why do you think you're one of us? Now get out of the way." Man did not get out of the way, and for this he received the first blow, a slap on the ear that sent him reeling. I drove my head into the older boy's ribs and knocked him down, landing astride his chest, from where I commenced to land two blows before his fellow oafs hurled themselves on me. The odds were 5-1 against me and my new friend Man, and even though I fought back with all my heart and rage, I knew we were doomed. All the other schoolboys surrounding us did too. So why, then, did Bond jump forth from that crowd and take our side?
He was a new boy who was as big as the older boys, true. But even so, he could not beat them all. One he slugged, another he elbowed, a third he rammed, and then he, too, was brought down by the horde. So they kicked us and hit us and beat us, and left us bruised, bloody, and elated. Yes, elated. For we had passed some mysterious test, one that separated us from the bullies on the one side, and the cowards on the other. That very night, we snuck out of our dormitory and made our way to a tamarind grove. And under its boughs we cut our palms. We mingled our blood once more with boys we recognize as more kin to us than any real kin, and then gave one another our word. A pragmatist, a true materialist, would dismiss this story and my attachment to it as romanticism. But the story says everything about how we saw ourselves and one another at that age, as boys who knew instinctively that their cause was to stand up for the weaker. Bon and I had not talked about that incident in a long time, but I sensed that it was in his bloodstream, as well as mine, as we sang songs from our youth on the way to our destination at the Roosevelt Hotel. Once a swinging establishment on Hollywood Boulevard for celebrities in the black-and-white era, the Roosevelt was now as unfashionable as a silent film star. Worn rugs masked shabby tiles, and for some reason, the lobby's furniture comprised card tables and chairs with the spindly legs of cranes, ready for games of penny poker and solitaire. I had expected some residual splash of Hollywood glamour, with paunchy porn producers in butterfly collars and powder blue blazers, leading demi-glazed women by their bejeweled hands. But the best-dressed people in the hotel appeared to be my fellow countrymen, bedecked in sequins, polyester, an attitude as we headed to the lounge where Fantasia waited. The other patrons, presumably the hotel guests, wore plaid shirts, pediatric shoes, and 7 o'clock shadows, the only thing in tow an oxygen tank. We always arrived late for everything, including, apparently, Hollywood's fashionable moment. Nevertheless, the atmosphere inside the hotel's cozy lounge was buoyant. Some entrepreneur had rented out the space to stage Fantasia, and the result was a refuge without any signs of refugees. The men, sharp in tailored suits, and the women, delectable in ball gowns. Our aspiring bourgeoisie had found 40-hour-a-week jobs with overtime and, having padded their wallets enough to sit more comfortably, were now on the hunt for wine and song. As Bon and I settled into a table at the back, a winsome singer in a bolero jacket serenaded the lounge with a heart-ache-soaked version of Pham Duy's City of Sadness. Was there any other way to sing about a city of sadness, the portable city carried by all of us in exile? After love, was sadness not the most common noun in our lyrical repertoire? Did we salivate for sadness, or had we only learned to enjoy what we were forced to eat? These questions required either Camus or cognac, and as Camus was not available, I ordered cognac. I paid for the snifters without a twinge from my dwindling settlement cash, being of the firm belief that money did not live until it was spent, particularly in the company of friends. When I spotted the grizzled captain and the affectless lieutenant standing at the bar nursing beers, I even sent them snifters of cognac. They came over to our table and toasted my comradeship, even though I had not yet brought up the matter of my return with the general again. That was my intent, though, and I was happy to buy us all another round. Cognac made everything better, the equivalent of a mother's kiss for a grown man. And so it was that we indulged, as the singers shimmied on the stage one by one. Men and women, they crooned, they wailed, they sighed, they belted, they moaned, they roared, and no matter what they sang or how, the crowd adored them. We were, all of us, even Bon, airlifted back in time by the lungs of the singers, across years and miles, to nightclubs in Saigon with a taste of champagne, besides the usual flavors and hints, always carried a touch of tears. Too many tears, and one was overpowered. None, and one was not enslaved. But a drop of this elixir was all one's tongue needed before it could utter only one name, Saigon. That word was mentioned by nearly every one of the performers and by the MC himself. This guide to Fantasia was a modestly built man, modestly dressed in a gray flannel suit, the only shiny thing about him being his spectacles. I could not see his eyes, but I recognized his name. The poet was a writer whose works had appeared in the literary journals and newspapers, gentle and nostalgic verses about the textures of everyday life. I remembered one in particular about the epiphany to be found in the washing of rice, and while I could not remember the poet's epiphany, I remembered the urge in the poem to find meaning in even the meanest of chores. Sometimes, when I washed rice and sunk my hands into the wet grains, I thought of the poet. I was proud to see that in our culture a poet could be an MC for a night of song and wine for the common people. We respected our poets, and assumed they had something important to teach us, as this poet did. He had written a few columns for Sonny's newspapers, explaining the vagaries of American life, or the cultural miscommunications between Americans and us. And in this vein, he interspersed his introductions of the singers with brief lessons in our culture, or the American culture. When it came time for Lana, he began by saying, "Some of you may have heard that the Americans are a people who like to dream. It's true. And although some say that America is a welfare state, in actuality it is a dream state. Here, we can dream of anything, can't we, ladies and gentlemen? I will tell you what my American dream is," he said, holding the microphone with the care one reserved for a stick of dynamite. "My American dream is to see once more, before I die, the land where I was born, to taste once more the ripe persimmons from the tree of my family's garden in Tai Ninh. My American dream is to return home so I can light incense at the tomb of my grandparents, to roam that beautiful country of ours when it is at last peaceful, and the sound of guns cannot be heard over the shouts of joy. My American dream is to walk from city to village to farm, and to see boys and girls laughing and playing who have never heard of war, from Da Nang to Da Lat, from Ka Mau to Chao Dak, from Sa Dek to Song Kao, from Vien Hoa to Ban Ne Thuat." The train ride through our cities and towns, great and small, continued. But I had gotten off at Ban Ne Thuat, my hometown, hilltown, town of red earth, highland country of the finest coffee beans, land of booming waterfalls, of exasperated elephants, of the half-starved Jarai in their loincloths, barefoot and bare-breasted, land where my mother and father died, land where my umbilical cord was buried in my mother's meager plot, land where the heroic People's Army struck first in its liberation of the South during the Great Campaign of 75, land that was my home. "That is my American dream," said the poet, "that no matter the clothes I wear, or the food I eat, or the language I speak, my heart will be unchanged. This is why we gather here tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Though we cannot be home in reality, we can return in fantasia." The audience applauded sincerely and enthusiastically for our diasporic poet laureate, but he was a wise man who knew that we were gathered here for another purpose besides hearing him. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, raising his hand to still the crowd, "may I present to you another American dream, our very own Vietnamese fantasy. Now known by just one name, like John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Mary, she stepped on stage clad in a red velvet bustier, a leopard print miniskirt, black lace gloves, and thigh-high leather boots with stiletto heels. My heart would have paused at the boots, the heels, or the flat, smooth slice of her belly, naked in between miniskirt and bustier. But the combination of all three arrested my heart altogether, and beat it with the vigor of a Los Angeles police squad. Pouring cognac over my heart freed it, but thus drenched, it was easily flambéed by her torch song. She turned on the heat with her first number, the unexpected, "I'd Love You to Want Me," which I had heard before sung only by men. "I'd Love You to Want Me" was the theme song of the bachelors and unhappily married males of my generation, whether in the English original or the equally superb French and Vietnamese renditions. What the song expressed so perfectly from lyric to melody was unrequited love, and we men of the South love nothing more than unrequited love. Cracked hearts are our primary weakness after cigarettes, coffee, and cognac. Listening to her sing, all I wanted was to immolate myself in a night with her to remember forever and ever. Every man in the room shared my emotion as we watched her do no more than sway at the microphone. Her voice enough to move the audience, or rather to still us. Nobody talked, and nobody stirred except to raise a cigarette or a glass, and utter concentration not broken for her next, slightly more upbeat number. Bang, bang, my baby shot me down. Nancy Sinatra sang it first, but she was merely a platinum princess, whose only knowledge of violence and guns was derived second-hand from the mob friends of her father, Frank. Lana, in contrast, had grown up in a city where gangsters were once so powerful the army fought them in the streets. Saigon was a metropolis where grenade attacks were commonplace, terror bombings not unexpected, and wholesale invasion by the Viet Cong a communal experience. What did Nancy Sinatra know when she sang Bang Bang? To her, those were bubblegum pop lyrics. Bang Bang was the soundtrack of our lives. Moreover, Nancy Sinatra was afflicted, as the overwhelming majority of Americans were, with monolingualism. Lana's richer, more textured version of Bang Bang layered English with French and Vietnamese. Bang Bang, je ne l'oublierai pas, went the last lines of the French version, which was echoed by Pham Duy's Vietnamese version, We Will Never Forget. In the pantheon of classic pop songs from Saigon, this tricolor rendition was one of the most memorable, masterfully weaving together love and violence in the enigmatic story of two lovers who, regardless of having known each other since childhood, or because of knowing each other since childhood, shoot each other down. Bang Bang was the sound of memory's pistol firing into our heads, for we could not forget love, we could not forget war, we could not forget lovers. We could not forget enemies, we could not forget home, and we could not forget Saigon. We could not forget the caramel flavor of iced coffee with coarse sugar, the bowls of noodle soup eaten while squatting on the sidewalk, the strumming of a friend's guitar while we swayed on hammocks under coconut trees, the football matches played barefoot and shirtless in alleys, squares, parks, and meadows, the pearl chokers of morning mist draped around the mountains, the labial moistness of oysters shucked on a gritty beach, the whisper of a dewy lover saying the most seductive words in our language, Anoy, the rattle of rice being threshed, the working men who slept in their sea clothes on the streets, kept warm only by the memories of their families, the refugees who slept on every sidewalk of every city, the slow burning of patient mosquito coils, the sweetness and firmness of a mango plucked fresh from its tree, the girls who refused to talk to us and who we only pined for more, the men who had died or disappeared, the streets and homes blown away by bombshells, the streams where we swam naked and laughing, the secret grove where we spied on the nymphs who bathed and splashed with the innocence of the birds, the shadows cast by candlelight on the walls of wattled huts, the atonal tinkle of cowbells on mud roads and country paths, the barking of a hungry dog in an abandoned village, the appetizing reek of the fresh durian one wept to eat, the sight and sound of orphans howling by the dead bodies of their mothers and fathers, the stickiness of one's shirt by afternoon, the stickiness of one's lovers by the end of lovemaking, the stickiness of our situations, the frantic squealing of pigs running for their lives as villagers gave chase, the hills afire with sunset, the crowned head of dawn rising from the sheets of the sea, the hot grasp of our mother's hand. And while the list could go on and on and on, the point was simply this. The most important thing we could never forget was that we could never forget. When Lana was finished, the audience clapped, whistled, and stomped, but I sat silent and stunned as she bowed and gracefully withdrew, so disarmed I could not even applaud. As the poet introduced the next performer, all I heard was bang bang, and when Lana returned to the table reserved for the performers, with the seat next to her left empty by the singer who had replaced her, I told Lon I would be back in 10 minutes. I heard him say, "Don't do it, you stupid bastard." But without further thought, I began my walk across the lounge. The hardest thing to do in talking to a woman was taking the first step, but the most important thing to do was not to think. Not thinking is more difficult than it sounds, and yet, with women, one should never think. Never. It simply won't do. The first few minutes in approaching girls, during my lycée years, I had thought too much, hesitated, and as a result flailed and failed. But even so, I discovered that all the childhood bullying directed at me had toughened me, making me believe that being rejected was better than not having the chance to be rejected at all. Thus it was that I approached girls, and now women, with such Zen negation of all doubt and fear, the Buddha would approve. Sitting down next to Lana and thinking of nothing, I merely followed my instincts and my first three principles in talking to a woman. Do not ask permission, do not say hello, and do not let her speak first. I had no idea you could sing like you do when I first met you, I said. She looked at me with eyes that evoked those ancient Grecian statues, empty and yet expressive. Why would you? I was only 16. And I was only 25. What did I know? I leaned close to be heard over the music and to offer her a cigarette. Fourth principle, give a woman the chance to reject something else besides me. If she declined the cigarette, as any of our proper young women should, I had an excuse to take one myself, which gave me a few seconds to say something while she focused on my cigarette. But Lana unexpectedly accepted, giving me the chance to fire up her cigarette with a suggestive flame, as I had once lit up Miss Mori. What do your father and mother think of all this? They think it's a waste of time to sing and dance. I suppose you agree with them. I lit my own cigarette. If I agreed with them, would I be here? You agree with everything my father says. I agree with only some of the things your father says, but I don't disagree with anything. So you agree with me when it comes to music? Music and singing keep us alive, give us hope. If we can feel, we know we can live. And we know we can love. She blew smoke away from me, though I could have been delighted to have her blow smoke in my eyes or in any part of my body. My parents fear singing will ruin me for marriage, she said. What they want for me is to get married tomorrow to someone very respectable and rich. You're neither of those things, are you, Captain? Would you rather I be respectable and rich? You'd be much less interesting if you were. You might be the first woman in the history of the world who's ever felt that way, I said. All this time I kept my gaze fixed on hers, an enormously difficult task, given the gravitational pull exerted by her cleavage. While I was critical of many things when it came to so-called Western civilization, cleavage was not one of them. The Chinese might have invented gunpowder and the noodle, but the West had invented cleavage, with profound, if underappreciated, implications. A man gazing on semi-exposed breasts was not only engaging in simple lasciviousness, he was also meditating, even if unawares, on the visual embodiment of the verb to cleave, which meant both to cut apart and to put together. A woman's cleavage perfectly illustrated this double and contradictory meaning. The breasts, two separate entities with one identity. The double meaning was also present in how cleavage separated a man from a woman and yet drew him to her with the irresistible force of sliding down a slippery slope. Men had no equivalent, except, perhaps, for the only kind of male cleavage most women truly cared for, the opening and closing of a well-stuffed billfold. But whereas women could look at us as much as they wanted, and we would appreciate it, we were damned if we looked, and hardly less damned if we didn't. A woman with extraordinary cleavage would reasonably be insulted by a man whose eyes could resist the plunge. So, just to be polite, I cast a tasteful glance while reaching for another cigarette. In between those marvelous breasts, bumped a gold crucifix on a chain, and for once I wish I were a true Christian so I could be nailed to that cross. "Care for another cigarette?" I said. Our gazers meeting once more as I offered her my pack. Neither of us acknowledged my expert appraisal of her cleavage. Instead, she silently accepted my offer, reached forth her delicate hand, plucked out a cigarette, inserted it between her candied lips, waited for it to be ignited from a flame in my hand, and then, gradually, smoked the cigarette until it dwindled to a handful of ashes, easily blown away. If a man survived the time taken to smoke the first cigarette, he had a fighting chance on the beachhead of a woman's body.
That I had survived a second cigarette boosted my confidence immeasurably. Thus, when the perm chanteurs whose chair I occupied returned, it was with confidence that I stood up and said to Lana, "Let's go to the bar." Principle 5, statements, not questions, were less likely to lead